This is the Global Greek Influence Podcast and I'm Panagiota Pimenidou. If you want to be up to date with the podcast content, subscribe, like and review the Global Greek Influence Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Anchor FM. In addition, you can contact the Global Greek Influence through the podcast Facebook and Twitter accounts, the podcast website globalgreekinfluence.com and the podcast page on LinkedIn. Today, Estathios Kyriakidis will discuss aspects of the future crisis and managing peace by the European Union through his role as the head of division, which is the language for civilians, and branch chief, militarily speaking, operations coordination in the EU military staff and deputy director of the EU maritime area of interest coordination cell. Estathios Kyriakidis' military career spans through 4 decades. Most notably, Estathios has been a J7 staff officer at Shape NATO between 2011 and 2014, while from 1990 to 1991, he was an air defense officer on board the Greek frigate Eli in participation to the Desert Storm, Desert Shield operations at the Persian Gulf. Estathios graduated from the Hellenic Naval Academy in 1990. Welcome to the show, Estathios.
Thank you very much, Yoda, for having me.
It's my pleasure. Could you introduce us to your role as the branch chief operations coordination in the EU military staff of the European External Action Service and your role as the deputy director of the EU Maritime Area of Interest Coordination Cell, MIICC?
Yes, definitely. So I will start by discussing what is the EUMS. Actually, there are five directorates in the UMS, one of which, allow me to say the most important, is the operations one. Operations directorate has 4 branches. One of the branches is the coordination, and I have the pleasure and the privilege to lead that branch. What we do in the coordination? We, as it suggests the name itself, we coordinate horizontally the staff work related to the operations, obviously, within the EUMS and within the institutions, not only the External Action Service, but also the Commission and the other European Union institutions. In addition, I deputize for the Director Operations and I deal with the European Union Operational Headquarters, that's a community of the Operational Headquarters pledged to the European Union by the Member States. And I would like to refer to the Greek one in Larissa, French one in Paris, German one in Ulm, Italian one in Rome, and the Spanish one in Rota. In addition, we have the military planning and conduct capability here in Brussels. And of course, I am this also MPCC is within that community. And I have a bad habit as a naval officer using acronyms and abbreviations. Therefore, please interrupt me if there are some acronyms that used are not easy to understand or easy to figure out what I mean. Now, in the European Union, we have actually 3 executive operations and 4 training missions. What's the difference? The operation, that's why I'm calling it executive, we, European Union, in essence, we replace the authority. We're not under an authority, a state, for example. While in the non-executive, that's why I'm calling them training missions, we are under a specific mandate after a request from a country. The 3 operations we run are Irini in the Mediterranean, Atalanta in the East Indian Ocean, and of course, in the Balkans, Bosnia and Herzegovina, the Operation Althea in coordination with NATO. And regarding the training missions, we have 1 in Somalia, 1 in the Republic of Central Africa, 1 in Mali, and the latest one started last year in Mozambique. Regarding my other role, the one of the Deputy Director Maik, this is a new role. I'm double-hatted. And we started this coordinated maritime presence of the European Union in 2019. So my role in that part is to coordinate, to lead a cell of subject matter experts naval officers to coordinate the European Union's member states' presences, vessels, naval presences around the globe.
For the sake of our discussion, I'm going to use the full names of all discussed policies, organizations, departments, as the audience and myself are not used to such terms. At the same time, shall we go a little bit back to what you mentioned? You referred to the 5 headquarters offered to the EU by the member states, and one of them is in Larissa, Greece. So I see that in case of a crisis in the region, the operational headquarters of any activities can be moved here in Larissa, Greece, right?
Well, not far from the truth. As we speak, we have 3 operations running. So ROTA commands the operation Atalanta. Rome commands the operation Irini. And NATO SHAPE commands the operation Althea. Should a crisis emerges, for example, in the Balkans, another one, or somewhere else in the world, it's not geographically limited, Larissa could be selected as the operational headquarters for that specific CSDP operation. For the time being, Ulm, the German one, provides the, let's say, the package for advanced planning to prepare ourselves, and Larissa assists for the time being to the conceptual development of our standard operating procedures, for example. Their role in Larissa is extremely important and acknowledged by the community.
We've all been shocked by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. If we go back to December 2014, we see that the EU advisory mission Ukraine was created to enhance the trust of the Ukrainian public towards government and security forces due to the Euromaidan revolution of dignity between 2013 and 14. In particular, the EU advisory mission Ukraine had a presence in Kyiv, Lviv, Odessa, Mariupol, and Kharkiv. Since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the EU advisory mission in the country could no longer realize its objectives. But in March and April 2022, the European Union member states redefined the tasks of the EU advisory mission in Ukraine. For instance, to support law enforcement agencies for the flow of refugees from Ukraine to the neighboring member states, and the entry of humanitarian aid into Ukraine, as well as to aid the rule of law institutions to help investigate and prosecute international crimes. What is the contribution of the EU common security and defense policy in Ukraine further to its mission in the country before its invasion?
Thank you very much. Very good question, of course. And I saw that you have already set the scene regarding our presence in the Ukraine since 2014. Indeed, when I'm using the term we, I'm always referring to the European Union, obviously. We were there assisting and executing all these tasks that you described. I would like to underline that when the war broke out, the mission left Kyiv, but now we're up and running again in Kyiv. We were in Moldova. Now, apart from the mission there, established back in 2014, EU supports, as everybody knows, in the context of the integrated approach, in every possible way and aspect, we support the Ukrainian people and government, politically, diplomatically, financially, and lately, militarily. What we do here in the European Union military staff? From the outbreak of the war, we have created a clearinghouse cell. What is the role of that cell? To coordinate supply and demand. We receive the Ukrainian armed forces requests for contributions, and we are matching these requests based on priorities, of course, that again, the Ukrainian armed forces set those priorities with the offer that we get from the member states. Not only the member states, though. In that cell, we also have United States, Canada, UK, Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, and Norway. And the door is open for other third states willing to contribute. How does it work? Here we have a daily meeting with the Ukrainian representatives and discuss what are, on a daily basis, the needs. Then, every week, based on priorities, we have a meeting in the premises of the European External Action Service with all the other stakeholders that I mentioned, and we decide what to send, where, and when. Now, we have to underline something very important here. For the very first time, and this is unique for the European Union, we have created a mechanism called the European Peace Facility, which is a fund to reimburse the member states that offer military equipment to Ukraine. Of course, the reimbursement is based on the priorities, and not all equipment is eligible for reimbursement. However, you have to take into consideration that it's a very powerful tool, a huge fund, which obviously assists and makes sure that the equipment will be delivered. Now, we're talking about equipment. This military equipment is directly sent by the member states. EU is not involved. So the member states select what to send based on the priorities and the requests. And of course, the EU, ourselves, decides on the reimbursement.
This is very interesting, as many might think that the EU member states are free of charge sending equipment to Ukraine. And this is an aspect that has not really been seen or heard before. Now, we are going to go a little bit more towards the common security and defense policy. It was actually the European Security and Defense Policy that has been renamed to Common Security and Defense Policy according to the Lisbon Treaty. And the Common Security and Defense Policy is actually the operational branch of the Common Foreign and Security Policy. Through the Common Security Defense Policy, the European Union decides to deploy crisis management missions and use military and civilian resources to contribute to implementing the broader goals of that policy. Why should the European Union consider extending its Common Security and Defense Policy from conflict prevention to a security actor by not treating the invasion of Ukraine in isolation, despite the country is not an EU state? And I'm putting my question in this context because I was thinking as a European Union citizen that we do not have to go through such crises at our borders to take a more decisive action towards such policies.
Very good question again. Very interesting. You give me the opportunity now to clarify the huge difference between NATO, which is a purely military organization, an alliance, and the European Union, which is a primarily political and economic entity. So, yes, we would love to have something more robust regarding defense, but we have to underline that since most of the European Union member states are also members of NATO, they rely on the Article 5 of the alliance, which is the collective defense. They rely on that for their security. What I mean is that, for example, if there's an attack on one NATO member, the others are obliged by the treaty to defend that member. Now, when it comes to the European Union, who aspires to be a security provider for the member states and abroad, the Treaty of the European Union, for the first time, and I'm talking about the Lisbon Treaty, in the Article 42-7, clearly states that similarly to Article 5, the European Union member states should, again, should contribute to the defense of a one member state under attack. However, this is an asterisk. In the second paragraph of the same article, it states that without prejudice to the NATO commitments of these member states. Now, this could be interpreted in various ways, and I will not elaborate further on that. I would also like to underline that apart from the external borders, the Treaty of the Function of the European Union, the TFEU, in the Article 222, there is the Solidarity Clause. What does it mean? If there is a catastrophe in a country, namely the fire, wildfire, a flood, an attack, terrorist attack, then the other member state should, and again I underline, should send, provide assistance and contribute. So regarding defense, NATO. Regarding internal issues, the European Union. I'm not sure if I covered your question, but for going towards a strategic autonomy of the European Union, we have to keep in mind that should a complementarity between the two organizations should be in place.
In my follow-up question, I'm going to focus mostly on the first part of your answer. Could you give us an example of what happens in the hypothesis that a non-EU country attacks an EU member state while both countries are NATO members?
Very good question. Very good question. Since we're talking about in the NATO context, it has not been foreseen such a situation when a NATO member is under attack by another NATO member. When it comes to the European Union, again, let me underline that it's up to the member states of the European Union to assist, to provide assistance and defense to that member state based on the Article 42-7. We do have the framework. However, obviously, we need the political will. Therefore, the 42.7 article of the Treaty of the European Union allows for a defense action by the other European Union member states.
So one understands, despite the complementarity of the European Union when it comes to its defense and foreign affairs policy with NATO, any decision made is based on interpretation.
It is not like NATO. In NATO, the Article 5 is binding, legally binding. In the European Union, we do have the framework, but again, based on different probable interpretations. But it's good to have, towards the strategic autonomy, it's good to have at least the framework.
Now we're going to get to more specific aspects of the common foreign and security policy. In March 2022, the European Union officially approved its strategic compass, an action plan that aimed to strengthen the European Union security defense policy by 2030, making the Union, and I quote here, a stronger and more capable security provider. The ambition of the European Union strategic compass is to improve the European Union's ability to act decisively in crises and to defend its security and its citizens with a concrete implementation timetable. What makes the recently published EU strategic compass the platform for the European Union's future role in global security?
Okay, your questions are really at the point. I have to take that, to give you that. So what I would like to discuss is that indeed, we have to protect our citizens as the European Union, but also to contribute to international peace, security, and stability. So this led to the strategic compass. Let me explain how we could be that aspiring security provider by referring to these four, to the four pillars that the strategic compass has. First of all, we need to act quickly and effectively. To that end, we have created the European Union Rapid Deployment Capacity. We're talking about a 5,000 strong troops. In addition, we have created the readiness to deploy 200 experts for CSDP missions and operations, and they could be there at spot for 30 days minimum. Moreover, within the Strategic Compass, first pillar ACT, we have regular live exercises that was not the case before, European Union exercises. We have enhanced the military mobility, and by that term I mean we ease the way that the troops could move from one country to another. And last but certainly not the least, we have reinforced the CSDP missions and operations in order to improve the rapid decision-making, and we use now the European Peace Facility Fund that I referred previously, that gives us more flexibility. Now, going to the second pillar. The second pillar is secure. We have to secure efficiently. And what I mean is that we have to boost, we have already made provisions to boost the intelligence analysis capacity with specialized personnel in analysis based on the intelligence. In addition, we have developed a hybrid toolbox and relevant response teams here in our directorate that deals with the intelligence. Don't forget, we have now, for the first time, cyber defense policy in place, and we have developed the European Union Space Strategy for Security and Defense. Pillar three is to invest. We invest smartly and adequately. Again, within the provisions of the Strategy Compass. What we said, that the member states will have to enhance their defense expenditures, and we have to strengthen the European defense technological and industrial base. In addition, we do invest in new technologies, and we are going to achieve synergies within the new tool that we have created, of course, like 3 or 4 years, maybe more old, the PESCO, that means the Permanent Structured Cooperation, which has specific projects that the European industries are coming together under one membership and under one member state leadership to mitigate the shortfalls on the European Union military capabilities. Last, the pillar partner. The pillar partner is to partner selectively. To that end, we have developed more tailored bilateral partnerships with the like-minded states, for example, the United States, Canada, Norway, the UK, Japan. And in addition, we support many multi-million projects all over the globe on the capacity building of states that cannot do it by themselves. So you see, the Strategy Compass is a really powerful toolbox that will lead us, will take us to the new era, the era of EU being a credible security provider.
Speaking of the future era, how could the 2030 EU Strategic Compass Implementation Plan transform the European Union military strategy?
Very good point. And this is exactly what we're doing now. The European Union military staff has been tasked to provide a tangible implementation plan. Because as we speak, Compass, Strategy Compass, is just a document, a very well articulated document, but a piece of paper. We have to transform that piece of paper into giving us tangible results. So indeed, this is a very difficult exercise. We have created the first draft. It will be approved next week if everything goes as planned. And in that specific implementation plan, there are the modalities and the specificities of all actions that I described previously. Now, we do have an agreed framework in order to develop the plan. We also have the level of ambition for 2030. Now, what we need to do is to promote a common understanding of the threat analysis mainly, and then of all the ways and means to go towards the direction. I cannot go, obviously, into details on the implementation plan because still it's not approved. But hopefully next week we will be able to publish something on that.
So maybe you should have come next week. But anyway, we're looking forward to any relevant announcements. The European Union is the second largest exporter and the third largest importer in the world and greatly relies on maritime transport and infrastructure. On the 25th of January 2021, the first pilot of the new coordinated maritime presences concept was launched in the Gulf of Guinea off the coast of West Africa. In addition to the European Union's current naval operations in the Mediterranean and the Western India Ocean, the coordinated maritime presences also includes, and I'm quoting here, implementation in any maritime area of the world determined by the Council of the European Union as a maritime area of interest, use of existing EU member states, naval and air assets present or deployed voluntarily in these maritime areas of interest, enhanced coordination of naval and air assets which remain under national command. So how could the pilot coordinated maritime presence concept be extended to other areas of European Union interest, therefore ensuring future maritime area security, the international collaboration and partnership at sea?
An excellent question. But let me start by saying that the coordinated maritime presences is a concept that started in 2019. And I was privileged to be among those who started the drafting of it. Let me explain that there are cases when the European Union member states agree to launch an operation, as we have in the Mediterranean and in the Indian Ocean, based, of course, on a mandate from the United Nations Security Council resolution. Now, there are other cases when either the member states do not agree to launch an operation or simply we don't have to. Therefore, we needed another tool, a tool to promote the European Union's maritime dimension in support of the shipping industry, of course, and to enhance our posture as European Union to be a credible security provider, but also a reliable partner. Therefore, we came with this European Union coordinated maritime presences idea and concept. What is exactly that? It is not an operation, it is an action, CFSP action. Therefore, completely different than the existing operations. Should we decide to launch an operation in the same area, we can do it, but then we'll switch from a CMP to an operation. Now, what we need, first, we need a council decision to establish specific coordinates for a maritime area around the globe, you name it, Atlantic, India, Pacific Ocean, specific coordinates to establish a maritime area of interest for the European Union, and the same council decision to establish a relevant MAIC, Maritime Area of Interest Coordination Cell. Now, in that, and I'm talking the concept in general, then I will go to the pilot case in the Gulf of Guinea. Now, in that specific maritime area of interest, we have deployed units of the member states. When I'm saying units, I'm talking about maritime patrol aircraft, I'm talking about naval vessels, you name it. So these units are also tasked nationally, and you have to be very careful on that, nationally, not by us, to assume additional tasks. For example, we coordinate a port visit in a specific port in Africa to be correlated with an official visit of a high-ranking official of the European Union. That's a good stratcom for the European Union. In addition, we could have capacity-building exercises between a European Union vessel and a coastal state navy. Now, the member state retains at all times the national command and control. That means our job is just to provide a platform for coordination in order to coordinate those presences. Let's go to the pilot case. The pilot case was decided to be in the Gulf of Guinea. So the maritime area of interest coincided with the Yaounde architecture maritime security existing framework. It is more or less the whole of the Gulf of Guinea. Now, in that area, that was the first case, therefore pilot case, in that area in January 2022, we started the coordination of the deployments of the member states. 2 years after, was the success story? Definitely yes. Why? First, we almost tripled the European Union naval presence in the area. Second, we almost, and allow me to use the term, eliminated the piracy in the Gulf of Guinea. Very few incidents in 2021, and it's almost one or two, if I recall, in 2022. And we managed to have at least one vessel, from one to five vessels in the area throughout the year, both in 21 and 22. And last but not least, again, trying to explain the success story, we have created confidence, we built confidence between the European Union and the local actors that serve the Yaounde architecture, and mainly the Interregional Coordination Center in Yaounde, but also other centers in the area. We didn't talk before. Now we coordinate, and this is a big plus. Of course, it would be very selfish to say that the piracy was eliminated due to the existence of the MAIC and the CMP concept. No, but we should take at least some credit, because based on what I explained, we saw that it was a huge reduce. In addition, and I will close with that, in addition, in 2022, the Council extended our mandate until 2024. And the European Union decided to stop calling the Gulf of Guinea as a pilot project because it is a success story again.
The global landscape changes due to the multipolarity of geographical, economic, and military influencers. One sees that as the EEAS covers areas of the world, such as Africa, the Americas, Asia and Pacific, Eastern Europe and Central Asia, Middle East and North America. In April this year, the Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of State and the EEAS Secretary General had the third meeting of the Interagency U.S.-EU Dialogue on China and the second U.S.-EU High-Level Consultation on the Indo-Pacific. What is the EU's role in the Indo-Pacific region?
Again, a very good question and a very practical one. On 19th of April 2021, the Council, the European Union Council, adopted conclusions on a new enhanced EU strategy for the cooperation in the Indo-Pacific. What we need to know and to observe is that that region is increasingly becoming strategically important for us. And we are highly interconnected with everyone in the area. And when I'm saying everyone in the area, I'm talking about too many other stakeholders. China, as you mentioned it, Russia is in the area, and Japan is in the area, everybody. So the current dynamics are characterized by the geopolitical competition, increasing tensions, and of course, jeopardizing the trade and supply chains. So what we did, we created the strategy to focus, to tackle these challenges, and to build lasting, strong relationships in the area. Now, we invite everybody to come on board and try to figure out how to resolve the several issues in the area. And let me go to the second maritime area of interest. In 2022, last February, the Council established a second maritime area of interest in the Northwest Indian Ocean. We cover, the coordinates are really showing a huge area. We cover the Red Sea, from the Gulf to Madagascar. So we're talking about a huge area. That will be the new maritime area of interest, NWIO, Northwest Indian Ocean. Of course, the difference between the new MAI and the one already running for 2 years are huge. First, in that area, in the Indian Ocean, as you mentioned, we do have an operation running, Atalanta, since 2008, and a successful operation, despite the fact that the latest mandate deprived us from the privilege to go in the Somalian territorial waters. But we still keep the vessels out of the territorial waters and do exactly the same tasks, slightly modified, in the area. The second, since 2019, there is a new initiative in the area, the European Maritime Awareness in the Strait of Hormuz. We call it MSO. It is not an EU initiative. It's a European-led initiative, mainly by France. And they run a naval operation in the area called Agenor. Their headquarters, operational headquarters, is co-located with the French, in the French naval base in Abu Dhabi. So, in addition, we do have one failed state, Somalia, and a war in Yemen. And having said that, we have to keep also in mind there are several other dangers, like, for example, what happened 2 weeks ago in the two Greek-flagged vessels that were seized by Iran, and that was characterized as a state piracy. For all these reasons, and exactly because we are giving a big, we are touching a big importance in the area, it could be the center of gravity for our policy, we have also created this maritime area of interest.
One final question, Evstathios, as we approach the end of our discussion. The European Union and NATO, two separate and different in nature organizations, have full transparency between them to encompass their strategic partnership in crisis management. What is the level of independent control of the EU military missions by the EU military staff regarding NATO?
Very good question again. I have to to compliment each and every question that you made. Okay, first of all, I would like to underline that we are absolutely autonomous in command and control of the operations. No involvement regarding NATO. But we also have to understand that one of our operations, the Operation Althea, we have a close cooperation with NATO because it is based on a mutual agreed framework back since 2002, the so-called Berlin Plus arrangements. What does it mean? We, European Union, could run an operation with recourse to NATO assets and capabilities. And this is the case in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Now, these kind of arrangements are made 20 years ago, and we could say they are kind of obsolete as we speak. Sometimes, for obvious reasons, everyone can understand, political reasons, this agreement is more hampering than facilitating the execution of an operation. However, that is why we do have joint declarations between NATO and EU to take us forward. Having said that, this framework worked for 20 years, but we need to progress as the two organizations are complementing each other, keeping their autonomy. So yes, that is a case when we're talking about Althea. But for all the other cases, two executive operations and four missions, we have a strict, clear chain of command, no NATO involvement. And we're talking about the strategic level here in Brussels, then led by the Political and Security Committee, then the operational level, one of the operational headquarters runs the operation, and again, Atalanta by Rota, Spain, and Irini by Rome, Italy. And tactical level, we have troops on the ground, and we're talking about the vessels at sea in our case. On top of that, the MPCC, the Military Planning and Conduct Capability, is commanding and controlling all four training missions.
Thank you, Evstathien, for accepting the Global Greek Influence podcast invitation and being here today.
Thank you very much. It was a really pleasure for me being here in this fantastic sunny afternoon in Brussels. Seldom to find a sunny afternoon in Brussels. And I would like to underline as my final statement, I would like to say that we, the European citizens, are on a very important crossroad. We have to see the future of defense of the European Union. And we're crossing our fingers that the outcome, the selection, the decision of which path the defense should follow will be the correct one. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. It has been an honor to have you with us today. Thank you all for staying until the end. Please remember that if you don't want to miss another live streaming on YouTube, subscribe to the YouTube channel Yota Pimenidou and the podcast platforms for a new episode every 2 Sundays. Until next time.